Welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution on Podclips. This podcast is designed to offer valuable perspectives and insights to individuals engaged in the mediation process. Listeners will benefit from the experience of the profession's most accomplished mediators who share compelling stories of conflict and the lessons they have learned from handling challenging and intriguing disputes. Throughout the episodes, you will hear firsthand accounts of how conflict has impacted the lives of those involved and discover how mediation enables individuals to move forward free from the burden of ongoing disputes. The discussions on this podcast provide practical guidance on addressing and overcoming difficult issues, helping listeners achieve more satisfying outcome in mediation. Whether you're a mediator, an attorney, or someone who has participated or is considering participating in mediation, you'll find actionable advice and encouragement. Your host, Len Levy, is a mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading provider of alternative dispute resolution. Len brings extensive experience, having litigated complex cases for over 30 years before transitioning to mediation in 1998, and has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. Len Levy's expertise and dedication set the stage for insightful conversations and meaningful learning for all listeners. And now, your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, and thank you for joining us in Season 6 in Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast designed to add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. In each podcast episode, you've heard a story about conflict, the impact it had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was achieved, and the lessons learned from both the conflict and its resolution. Now, many of the details of the story you're about to hear may have been altered to maintain the essential confidentiality of mediation, while still capturing the core of the conflict and its resolution. Today, joining me is Justice Thomas Wilhite, who I have gotten to know over the past few months, and I'm going to be addressing him as Tom today, and he is one of the most, let's say, accomplished and complete human beings you're ever going to want to meet. He's very personable. He is easy to talk to. I have no doubt as to those attributes being brought to a mediation have contributed to the success that he has had. There are many judges and justices who do mediation, and some of them are very personable, and some of them are maybe a little less. But I will tell you, when you have a mediation with Tom Wilhite, you are really being treated to an experience, and you're going to be in the hands of someone who has a distinguished judicial career for more than 30 years. I mean, he was with the municipal court, if you remember, before court consolidation. He served in the trial court and in the appellate court. He's basically excelled at every level that he has in the profession. Lawyers have indicated his strength as a judge is his willingness to do the hard work of learning about and sorting through difficult legal issues. And he does that in his mediations. He is extremely hardworking, and he cuts to the chase and has the ability to discuss what's really going on, demonstrating to quote one of the attorneys, a combination of thoughtfulness, careful research, good common sense, and judgment. I welcome you, Tom. I thank you very much for joining us on this podcast. And I understand that you have a story. It involves wrongful death and a few other things. And I'm not going to preview it. I'm going to let you tell it.
All right. Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for that very, very kind introduction. I hope I can live up to all of those compliments in my career. Yes, Len, I would like to talk about a wrongful death case that I mediated. And like all wrongful death cases, it was tragic. And there were some legal and evidentiary twists and turns that came out during the mediation. But essentially, I'm going to give you the plaintiff's case here, and then we'll get into some nuances, I'm sure, later. But the decedent was a trainee truck driver for a trucking company that picked up and replaced large refuse bins at industrial businesses. And the accident that resulted in his death occurred around 5 a.m. For training purposes that morning, he was the passenger in this truck. And he was being trained by the driver, who was an experienced driver with the trucking company. And this truck was not like your typical garbage truck. This is a larger truck, and these refuse bins are very large, and they're held securely on a hydraulic forklift at the rear of the truck. And so this truck was carrying such an empty refuse bin secured on that forklift. And their task was unload that bin, pick up the a used bin, and replace the used bin with the new bin. So they arrive at the business that they're servicing, and one of the security guards directs the driver to follow him to the location where the used bin is located. It's located on a small alley off a public boulevard adjacent to the property. And as I said, the truck had to back up on the street and then turn, still backing into the alley. Before the truck started backing up, the decedent got out of the truck and placed himself on the sidewalk adjacent to the boulevard. He was behind the truck, but he was off to the side. He had his back turned because he was approaching the entrance to the alley where the truck was going to have to back up. A security guard was in the street and was motioning the driver to back up towards the alley, giving him the all clear sign, just keep coming, as if there was no danger. It was still dark. The driver could see the security guard in the rear view mirror. He did not see the decedent, and he assumed that he was out of the way. As the truck was backing up, the empty bin on the forklift, again, they're very large, struck the decedent in the head, and he was dead at the scene. And so there were obviously some significant issues of comparative negligence, the main issue here was the defendant was the security guard's company, the employer of the security guard, and they were being sued under the theory that he had assumed the duty to direct the truck to back up. But and I can talk a little bit about the evidence of that, but there was a lot of duty, a lot of issues that would be involved, factual and legal, with that theory. There were some conflicts in the evidence. At the deposition, the security guard denied telling the driver to back up, signaling him. There was security cam footage which showed someone approaching the truck and waving to the truck to follow him down the boulevard. But it was too blurry to identify that person, and the person passed out of sight during the particular waving during the backing up that was an issue. The key evidence for the plaintiffs was that at the scene, the police interviewed both the driver and the security guard that they were contending was the offending party, and it was preserved on body cam video. The driver in the video, which counsel played for me, is clearly distraught. He's standing next to the security guard. The security guard's also listening. And when the police ask him how the accident occurred, the driver says, he gestures at the security guard and he says that he was telling me to back up. He was waving me as if everything was okay. So I figured it was okay, and I backed up and I struck the decedent. And the security guard doesn't say anything. And then the driver also said the same thing to the Cal OSHA investigator. Now, the problem was that the driver no longer worked for the security guard company and couldn't be located for deposition. And the security guard in deposition denied that he was involved at all, denied that the video from the security camera showing someone approaching the truck was him. And so, there were some significant evidentiary issues, actually on both sides, but that was the real kind of, that's the general description of the case.
Okay, so the decedent's estate, who was pursuing this as the plaintiff in the case?
The plaintiffs were the decedent's wife and two children. They were, one was a son, about 20 years old. The other was a daughter at the time, 17 years old or so in high school.
Was there any indication that the decedent and his spouse and children had any issues between them, or were they close family, or what was
Well,
going on?
that's a very good question because that was another wrinkle here, Len. The wife and the decedent had been childhood sweethearts. They met each other when they were 11 and they got married very young. And they remained married. They had been married for about 25 years at the time of the accident. And they had two children. However, when the children were relatively young, about 14 years before this accident, the decedent got sentenced to prison for a drug offense. And he was released about 4 years before the accident. There was really significant evidence that the family kept in touch and visited him regularly while he was incarcerated, in person because he was local, but also through letters. The kids would send their artwork, report cards, that kind of thing to him. So there was a lot of contact among the family while he was in prison. And there was other significant evidence that once he was released, he really tried to make up for lost time. The family was living together in a house. He had immediately gotten work, blue collar work, not much money, but for instance, he had scraped together enough funds to help his son pay tuition at a trade school. Son was about 20. He had gone to a pawn shop and bought a camera for his daughter because she was interested in photography and art. He was encouraging her to go to college and promising that, we're going to do everything that we can to make that happen. And for them, when he got this truck driving job, this was the best job that he had gotten so far when he got out of prison. And so on their side, there was, significant evidence of a family relationship. Of course, as we know, in a wrongful death action, grief, emotional distress, it's not recoverable. What's recoverable is companionship, loss of companionship, loss of comfort. And so, there were some issues there that the defense was raising, respectfully, I will say, about the extent to which, the decedent having been in prison for a lengthy period of time, the extent to which there really was loss of comfort, companionship, et cetera. And at the very least, it was a relatively short period from their position. And I have to tell you, that's a difficult issue for a mediator to address with the decedents, but we, I mean the survivors, but we did have to cover it. So that was very interesting to me. The defense, the security guy was not present, and it was really it was the attorneys, two defense attorneys, and the insurance adjuster. So there wasn't, there wasn't that same kind of dynamic on the other side. But I will say they were. The defense was quite respectful of the tragic nature of the circumstances of the case as they should have been. And so that, made it easier for me when I was discussing some of these issues with them.
So the insurance company had been supplied what type of information that would bear on the damages and possible exposure here?
They had all of it. They had the depositions of the survivors. They had psychology reports relating to the extent of loss of companionship, et cetera. they had the totals of economic damages and lost future income, which was not great. That was not the key part of the recovery here. They had some information as to the cost of the funeral, but the key for the damages here was really the loss of companionship, loss of comfort. But they had everything that was going to be on that. They had deposed the survivors and had the therapist reports.
All right. So it sounds like everyone came prepared for the mediation, and we're going to find out just how prepared they were to meet the just usual kinds of, let's say, impediments to reaching a resolution. When we get back, and today we are discussing this wrongful death case with Tom Wilhite. We'll be back.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and I am chatting with Tom Wilhite, retired justice and excellent mediator, who is conveying a wrongful death case facts that were pretty compelling in terms of the effect that this might have had on their family. But I want to delve into that just a little bit more. How was the family affected by his death?
Well, and I was able to view portions of the video depositions of the survivors. They, you know, I really think that one of the factors here was the plain spokenness of the, especially the children. The wife was a little reticent, in a sense, but the children, the son and the daughter, were quite compelling and really basically said, yeah, my dad was in prison for a long time. We knew it. He did something he should have, shouldn't have. He told us he did something he shouldn't have. We wanted to stay in touch. And when he got out, it was a real, you know, he really made up for lost time, as I said, with us. And he was an important part of our lives. And here's some of the things that we would do together, family outings, you know, the typical kinds of things you'll see. But they had a very good description of their family life. And so for me, you know, that was something the defense is going to have to worry about. That, you know, damages could be limited, but there was significant potential liability there. And again, we had three plaintiffs. And so, you know, each of them had their own relationship. The mother, the wife, of course, this was her only love, the only man ever in her life. And to her, it didn't matter whether he was in prison or not. And when he came out, you know, now there are certainly things that a defense counsel skilled can cross-examine on this, but, you know, it's delicate, it's very, very delicate. And so, you know, my perspective was that there was pretty good evidence of you know, the loss of companionship and comfort, and it could be persuasive because they came off very well.
Now, did you know this going into the mediation session? And kind of a companion question here, did you have conversations with the attorneys for each side separately prior to that session?
Yeah, I always at least attempt to call the attorneys for both sides before the mediation. I did that here. The mediation briefing did not include the videos that I have mentioned, the depositions or the interviews or the security video, they brought that to the mediation. Obviously, both sides had seen it. It was all part of the discovery in the case. But the, you know, the, as I usually find when I talk to the attorneys before the mediation, and this case is no different, it gave me a chance to really get beyond what they say in their mediation briefs, which sometimes, you know, many, many times I want to be confidential, and they perhaps a little, maybe a little too much advocacy, even though they're confidential, but to really get behind it and get down to brass tacks with the attorneys from the outset, not being evaluative or anything like that, but basically, what in their view do I have to do to settle this case? What do you think is important here? And I discussed that with the plaintiff's counsel. I discussed that with defense counsel. We talked a little bit about issues, not much. I don't like to get into an evaluative posture early. Mm-hmm. So they had talked about some of the issues in the mediation briefing. And I also wanted to get a feel from the plaintiff's counsel how the wife and children, you know, their character a little bit, and how any difficulties we might have with the mediation, because they're going to want to show me the attorneys are some of these videos, and they could be very upsetting. You never see the decedent, you don't see the accident, but you hear the thing being described by someone who's nearly in tears,
right?
And you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, we talked about how to do that, and you know, letting the plaintiffs, you know, leave the room, and my being very, you know, respectful of them, of anything that might be triggering. So, you know, the phone call was helpful.
And
what to expect.
It gives you an idea as to who's driving the bus, so to speak.
Absolutely.
In terms of settlement. And sometimes expectations of clients, whether they're reasonable or not reasonable, enter into it. Was that the case here?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty clear to me that both sides had unreasonable expectations. The plaintiff's side had served 998 demands for a total of 2.9 million quite a while ago, but they were seeking a global settlement of 7 million. And, you know, I with respect to them, I just thought that was too high. The defense was offering 100,000. So we had this huge, huge gap that had to be bridged. And so I knew going in that both sides' expectations, in my view, defense too low, plaintiffs too high, we're going to have to work on that. That's not something I get into. I mean, I had a sense they were flexible, both sides, but you never know how much money's there, right, till you get going. And so we had certainly had a conflict of expectations at the outset.
So in approaching that, I mean, very often the decision that you as a mediator have to make is, when do we start getting into the actual numbers?
Yeah.
Because sometimes when you start getting into the numbers, that's all you discuss
right
from that point forward. So getting into the numbers effectively required you to do what in this mediation?
Well, it was more an issue in dealing with the plaintiffs than the defense. Obviously, the defense, as I said, they were very respectful, and you know, but it's an insurance adjuster there, and you know, there's only so much authority. So, and you're right, I didn't want to get into numbers too fast, especially with this gap. So my strategy was, especially on the plaintiff side, to you know, try to establish a relationship of trust and credibility with the attorneys, which I think I did, but also with the plaintiffs themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things I do in a case like this where there's liable to be a lot of emotion, and I did it in this case, you know, I say essentially, look, the mediation is a timeout from the litigation. We hope the case won't go further. This is your chance to be heard. And if you have anything you want to tell me about this case, whether it's legally relevant or not, I want to hear it. This is your chance. And so I was able to discuss a little bit of the emotion with them, and they were able to, I don't know if the word is vent, but talk a little bit about that, talk about how they've had to live with this, for this case has been pending a while. And so I really think that that helped me establish a position of trust with the clients as well as the attorneys, because it needed some delicate handling. On the other side, the real connection with the attorneys was, and I'm not tooting my own horn, but I knew the law. And this, yes, there was amount of damages, but also liability was an issue. And so there was some things they were arguing that we would have to talk about. And I would point out to them just, you know, this is a risk. And so that was really the way, you know, I'd cite them a case, I'd give them something short on my computer. So they knew that I knew what I was talking about. So I had established a level of trust with them that I was being transparent. I'm not just trying to beat them up when I get to the evaluation just to settle the case. There's actually something there. And by the way, I always call it the velvet hose. I don't call it the rubber hose, because I do it very gently, you know what I mean? And respectfully. I'm not someone who pounds the table and yells at people.
Let's switch back to the plaintiff's room.
Yeah.
You have parties who are, and pretty much always in cases like this, the only parties that are directly, individually, and deeply affected are the plaintiffs.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a business decision to be made in the defense room, and there's also a business decision to be made in the plaintiff's room.
Correct.
But that business decision is often clouded by the things that you've just described. Yeah. How did you break through that cloud cover?
Well, once I felt, and again, I had gone back and forth a couple of times, not spending lengthy periods of time with both sides, but just trying to lay some groundwork here. Once I felt I had the, you know, sense of trust and candor with the plaintiffs, and I had talked with the attorneys, I started talking a little bit more realistically about what the case was about. I did it delicately. For instance, you know, they were talking to me about their grief and their emotional distress. And I had to explain that, you know, really, that's not what we're focusing on here. It's really the loss of companionship. And there is going to be an issue, you know, with respect to what your relationship with your father really was, especially during the period he was in prison. So that's going to affect it. I also had to tell him that, you know, it doesn't sound fair, but there's also an issue of how much your father was negligent, because that's an issue here. There's a doctrine called comparative negligence, and, you know, all the damages are not necessarily going to be recoverable if they attribute some additional negligence to the driver or to your father. Very difficult to talk to them about that, but, you know, I think they understood. I really do, and I think the attorney said, and talk to them a little bit about it. But, you know, it's a delicate situation. Once I had gone through that, I did a more evaluative discussion, mainly with the attorneys, about their problems of proof, legal issues, et cetera. And once I had done that, we started talking numbers on that side. And that's when I went to the other side.
Both sides obviously have risk going to trial. It's always the case. And very often, plaintiff's attorneys are less risk adverse than their clients. Was that the case here? Was that a dynamic you needed to deal with?
Yes. Yes, it was. The attorneys, I think, had an expectation of recovery that I thought was too high. I mean, I think there would be, you know, significant recovery trial, but it was not in the range of the $7 million that they told me initially they wanted. They had said that before I did anything. And so I was able to convince them that, you know, it's not going to be, settlement certainly is not going to be $7 million in a trial, given all these issues here. You know, you got to knock down even $7 million if you wanted it to something. So, but yes, and ultimately that was the point of the evaluative analysis with them, pointing out some of the real risks in the evidence and the law.
Now, in the other room, I'm referring to the other room,
yeah,
because I'm assuming you're not doing this in a joint session.
No, so, yeah, I was shuffling back and forth. At the end, we had a joint session, but yes, I'm going
okay.
back.
Okay, And was this in person or was this?
In person.
Okay. We'll get into some of the pros and cons of that, but perhaps after the break. But what you are attempting to do now is to get everyone in a zone of possible agreement here. We're going to discuss a little bit more about that, and we're going to do that after a break. But I just wanted to establish the case did settle, correct?
Yes.
Okay. The how we make the sausage part is the interesting aspect of this. We're going to get into it a little bit more. You understand, results like this don't happen by accident. And knowing what tools to use and when to use them is going to be important. So we're going to be right back after a word from American Institute of Mediation.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and I am discussing with Justice Thomas Wilhite a wrongful death case and how that case got settled. You know, it occurred to me that one of the things that, as a justice, you did was you told people what the law is. How does that work and translate into a mediation practice?
Well, I think one of the reasons people hire me is because of my appellate experience and to talk about the legal aspects when there are some issues there. Obviously, for me, an evaluative approach is important, but you need to do it at the right time and you need to do it in a respectful way. So, citing the law, and then pointing out how under the evidence there's a risk here really makes it clearer, I think, than if I'm talking just off the top of my head about, for instance, the voluntary assumption of a duty. What are you going to have to prove? You know, how does the evidence fit into this? And the driver is in the wind. You can't get the driver. The security guard says it's not him. The evidence you have is probably an adoptive admission from the guard. If you hit big. Message to the other side is they could hit big. Message to the plaintiff is you may not hit. You know, it's that kind of thing. And it really helps to say, look, this is what you got to prove. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how you're going to prove it. And then we get into that kind of dynamic in terms of my attempting to point out in a really specific way. We've all lost cases we thought we should win and win cases we thought we should lose. Something more specific than that, especially in a case when the parties are so far apart and you really need to try to lower expectations for everybody.
And how did you get the gap closed between, if I recall, 100,000 and 7 million? Pretty big gap, like the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, it took time. I mean, the plaintiffs ultimately, you know, got off the notion if it's going to be, you know, 7 million. I got them down to about 2 million. I got the, by basically harping on these issues that you have comparative negligence, I raised something they really hadn't thought about, and I'm not sure why it wasn't part of the case, but there was also possible comparative negligence of the landowner, since the landowner is the one who controlled where the bin was placed and the placement of the bin was. And so if I'm the defense, I'm going to be raising that as well. So you got three potential sources of comparative negligence. And then, of course, you don't really have any lost economic damages. And so it's really going to depend on the companionship. And that's, who knows, that's a, you know, it could be big. It depends on how it comes out. You know, so I just continued to bring those issues up. With the defense, you know, I did point out that if, you know, if they hit it, you know, they've got significant damages here, especially you've seen the depositions of the plaintiffs. You know, they come across really well. You know, they can prove that you, the security guard assumed the duty to direct the driver to back up. Think of it just as a common sense. You know, you're driving, your wife's out of the car. She's telling you to back up, right? You trust her. You think she knows what's going on. And, you know, so using those, that kind of evaluative discussion, slowly but surely, we were able to narrow the gap. I was getting the insurer up into the $300,000 range. I was getting the plaintiffs down into about $1 million range. And once that happened, then I knew that we had something here that we could really, really work on. And a lot of the dynamic was from the plaintiffs themselves. They did want to settle. They wanted to put an end to this. And so they were frankly willing to take a little bit less than the attorneys would have wanted to put this behind them. So that was another dynamic as well.
It also sounds like the economic condition that the plaintiffs were in was such that the types of numbers you're talking about are significant to them.
Yes, correct.
They're life-changing to them.
Correct.
And so the idea of risking that amount of money, whatever the amount was that was being offered, to go to trial is something that gets into the risk-adverse nature of the plaintiffs here, I think.
Yes, yeah. And as you know, that's not infrequently the case. And I did, it was apparent to me that they really did, plaintiffs wanted to put this behind them. They wanted a fair settlement, but the kinds of money that I thought I could get would have been, as you said, life-changing for them. They've never had that much money in their life. So, yeah, that was part of the dynamic.
I've seen, and I obviously you've talked to a number of our colleagues as well, and your approach is a very human approach relating to the parties. In some cases, there are some retired judges that'll say, "Okay, well, this is how I would see it if this evidence was before me, and this is where it should settle." It doesn't sound like that's your approach.
Generally, no. In a case like this, where it's very party specific, I use this kind of approach. If I'm in a you know, just a pure business situation, the dynamic is a little bit less. But certainly, I think getting into any type of evaluation early on, before you establish a real level of trust and candor, the plaintiffs and the attorneys, is really a hindrance, because it's, you come in there guns blazing, it feels like, to the lawyers, and you're telling them you don't have any idea about this case. Here's what I say it's worth. And even if you don't want to put it that way, I think it's received that way. And maybe you get over that bump later on, but it's much more effective to, in my view, for my type of personality, to do it in a way that is respectful, having established a sense of credibility that I'm not just blowing smoke. This is a real risk.
We're talking about establishing credibility with the people, with the plaintiffs and their risk. The adjuster in the other room, Mm-hmm. It's also a person who has to answer to someone.
Yep.
And how do you approach talking to the defense side differently, if you do, than talking to the plaintiff side?
Well, one of the things that, happens in mediations, unfortunately, is, sometimes the adjuster is on East Coast time and we're operating on West Coast time. And so one of the things I always say at the outset is, I want you to understand, I expect you to be here for the entire mediation. Now, I don't have the ability to order them to be there, but it lets them know that, look, I'm here for the day, maybe longer. And if you really want to settle this on behalf of the insured, you need to be here. So the adjuster stuck with us. The mediation ran over before it settled, but the adjuster stuck with us. And in talking with the attorneys, I didn't give them numbers per se, but I did not know at the time what the authority of the adjuster was. They were very tight-lipped about that. But I knew we were getting close to what they were offering when they got to about 350, that was going to be. So I gently but firmly requested that, I'm going to end up with some numbers here that probably beyond your level of authority. Are you willing to call whoever needs to be called or trust the defense counsel here if they recommend a settlement, which they ultimately did? And he said, yeah, I'm willing to try. So then I knew I could go beyond what I felt their level was, how much beyond I didn't know. And so given where we were and given the lapse of time, some attorneys don't like to use brackets, some do. I find them useful to when you get to a certain level. So we started doing brackets. And they got closer and closer. And finally, I got the defense to commit to paying $500,000. And I said, I put it this way to the defendant, to the plaintiff. If I can get him to $500,000, well, that'll settle the case. Ultimately, not a bracket. It's me telling them, if right. I can get them there, will it settle it? So, I went to the plaintiffs. They agreed to, they talked with their attorneys. The attorneys talked to me and ultimately came back and said, yeah, they'll accept it. That's a lot of money for them. And so we had the settlement. Then, of course, we had to write up the settlement agreement, which took a little bit. I did not want this case. It's not one of those cases where it rarely is, but not one of those cases where you let it, you just say, okay, we're done. Why don't you circulate it later? I wanted it in writing. So we got it in writing. And then there were some other issues because obviously the workers' compensation case had taken care of the employment's liability, but there was apparently an unexpected workers' compensation lien that could be on the award. We worked that out. So there were other wrinkles there, but we got it done and got it signed by everybody.
And this was an in-person mediation.
Yes. I don't think we could have done it. This is one of those rare ones where I don't think we could have done it if it was virtual. And, I like virtual mediations, but this is one where I think really, especially on the plaintiff side, really being able to see them and talk to them, interact with them was key.
The approach that you have to relating to people is something that has come out in the story in the telling of this mediation. You've emphasized a number of times relating to people. I think one of the at least what I'm gathering from it is that the attorneys need to provide mediators with enough information so that you can lead into establishing that relationship with their clients. If they have problems with on the defense side, if they have problems with the adjuster, if the adjuster is, if it's I don't know if it's self-insured or if it's whatever the situation is there a problem with the adjuster? The idea that this case could have settled without you relating to the people, I think would be a false idea. relating to the people, it seems to me, was key. What do you think?
I think so. I do think ultimately the attorneys proved helpful, especially on the defense side. They listened to me. They were willing to recommend, you know, that the adjuster get more authority. The adjuster trusted the defense attorneys, so that was good. Not simply me, but he's got the people they hired to litigate this saying, yeah, we need to listen to this. So all of that combined, but from the mediator perspective, in a case like this, where emotions run high, where, you know, it's a tragic circumstance, I do think it's not always the case. If you just have a dry business, you know, contractual case or something, you don't need to necessarily go through all of this. But in a case like this, I do think it's very important to establish this connection with the lawyers and especially the parties.
We're pretty much done here because this has been a fantastic result that you've relayed, and your ability to bridge a gap, help the parties bridge a gap by recognizing risk and recognizing those things that they needed to reach a settlement. This was fantastic. I really am impressed with the result, and I'm impressed with how you handle yourself, Tom. I will tell you, you've impressed me. I'll tell you, thank you.
Hey, well, thank you, Len, for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, so as we wrap up, how can listeners contact you to hire you for mediation or learn more about what you do, or what's the best contact information?
The best contact information is my contact information at ADR Services, email or telephone to my case manager. I'm frequently willing to just give my cell phone out ultimately to call me personally to chat about things. But the good first notification is to the case manager. She will know what I've got going, what my potential availability is, that kind of thing. But also sometimes I just chat with attorneys who want to sound me out about whether I'm the right mediator, and that's fine.
Very good. And your case manager, I think, is Chelsea, correct?
That's correct.
So is that Chelsea team at adrservices.com?
That is indeed.
Okay. Well, very good. Tom, thank you once again for being a guest on this podcast, and I hope to have you back as a guest in the future. I really do enjoy talking with you. And thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. I am your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs. As we wrap up, I want everyone to understand that the value of mediation is what we are striving to depict in the stories we bring you. And until the next podcast, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.